Welcome back to another episode of Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler. On this podcast, we explore all things related to thriving and flourishing in life. There are three fundamental truths that inform not just my podcast, but my coaching as well. And they are, number one, the future can be changed. You are not stuck and you are not trapped by your predictable future. Wherever you are right now, it's just your present state. It does not determine where you can go in life. Fundamental truth number two, you can change your future. This might be the best news of all. You don't need to be rescued by someone else. You can do that for yourself. In other words, you can be your own hero. And fundamental truth number three, you do not have to wait. Too many people think that they have to have the perfect plan or all the knowledge or all the skills before they can get started. Nothing is further from the truth. I've coached a lot of people in my career. And trust me when I say that you can learn whatever it is that you need to learn along the way. The key is to start. If you've listened to the podcast before, you'll probably know that we find stories and experts who shed light on these different areas so that we can all flourish and thrive. Let's dive in to today's episode. My guest today is the co-author of the stigma-breaking book, Boys Do Cry, a collection of true stories by men who overcome adversity and gender conformity surrounding their mental health and emotions. He shares his life experiences in the hopes that it reaches someone who needs to harness their self-worth and overcome obstacles standing in the way of their truth. He is a father to an 11-year-old daughter, an ultra-marathon runner, and a music enthusiast. He is a man on a mission, raising awareness and bringing to light just how amazing life can be if you're courageous enough to take the first step. His name is Sean Coffey, and I hope that his story inspires you. Hey, Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So I'll tell you what, why don't you jump in and tell the listeners just a little bit about who you are and what you do?
At the current moment, I am a drug court case manager. So there's a National Association of Drug Court Professionals. There's a bunch of these drug courts around the U.S., but basically what we do is we take people who have extensive drug and criminal histories and put them through a program anywhere from 2 to 4 years so that they can rehabilitate. Because oftentimes we get into like jail or, you know, prison and going back and back and back and not getting anything out of it. I have roughly 14 years and 5 months without any substances, as well as 14 years of addiction, childhood trauma in there. I had an ACE score of 7, which is adverse childhood experiences. There's a rating system, which we can get into in a little while, but this test that they do proves or shows that there could be significant trauma in a person just by the experiences that they see as a child. So there's that. But for the last 8 years, I've been in either a mental health or a substance use related position. I think it's very often that when you get into this field and you feel what it feels like to grasp onto recovery, you want everybody in the world to do it, right? So the main thing that you see is people in recovery working in recovery, because it means so much to us to see other people get what we have. So
yeah,
that is Sean in a nutshell.
Yeah. So it sounds like really your background led you to what you're doing now.
100%. Yeah. And it didn't even really happen that way. I ended up being removed from a transitional housing program. And the executive director knew somebody in a veterans transitional housing. And I ended up actually in that program, and they kind of pushed that position on me, which was like, would you like to work with people in recovery? And I'm like, I don't know. I've never done this before. It seems really weird. Like, why would you want, you know, a recovering person to help? And then they explained it to me and I was like, okay, I'll try this. And that was my first position 8 years ago. So
still
kicking.
Still kicking. And it seems like you find that rewarding based on what you've said.
Yeah. I mean, at first I didn't really get it. It was just helping people, you know. My story has helped, you know, a ton of people, which I still find like mind blowing, but I didn't really grasp onto the reward part until I realized like I'd been in some situations where I got to see what the work actually did on the outside of our program. And I was just like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Wow. There's so much there I want to explore. I guess a natural point would be, you mentioned it, you know, your story and how it's helped so many people. So what would your story kind of be like? What's important for people to know?
So the background, I think, is the most important thing. And you can sum that up just by saying there was a lot of childhood trauma. But if I dove into that a little bit more, I would say that my dad was a person living with schizoaffective disorder. So that's a schizophrenia and traits of bipolar. So you can already imagine, you know, if you go off medicine or there's one certain medicine that goes by weight. And if you're not at that certain weight, it can have adverse effects. So he was also in childhood trauma as a kid himself. So it's a perpetual cycle, you know, and for him, that's all he knew. So coming full circle, I guess, fault him for any of that. But so we had, my entire childhood was just eggshells, like the whole thing. When the person who says that they love you the most is the one doing the most damage, that in lies where the, you know, where the problem started. So I had attention deficit issues as a kid and just trauma, you know, started at like 5 years old. So for me, growing up wasn't fun. There's some parts of it, I'm not going to lie. Like there's parts of me like remembering stuff that, you know, we did, but the positive and the fun things are few and far between over the other ones. So at 18, my dad wanted me to go into the military and our whole family's Air Force. And I thought it would be a supreme act of defiance if I joined the Marine Corps. So I went into the Marine Corps 3 days after I graduated high school. I was in there for long enough for me to equate the military as an extension of my dad, just with the discipline and the authoritative figures. And there was some type of a small hazing incident. And rather than working my way through it, I decided that it would probably be better for me to just leave. So I did leave 3 times. And when I went back, they greeted me with 45 days in the military prison and discharge papers. So shortly after I got out of the military, my dad passed away. And that is pretty much when I think everybody dabbles in high school, like, you know, drinks here and there, goes to a party and sees other people, you know, smoking weed or whatever. And sometimes it's harder than that. But so I did start, you know, doing that stuff around freshman year. So that's like a, you know, an aside. And when he passed away, I got a life insurance policy and I decided to use half of it on a vehicle and half of it on drugs. So that's how my, you know, drug stuff started. And then lots and lots of stuff in between there. I had a relapse for 4 years, but I ended up basically just one day being like, this is going to kill me. And that wasn't for me to kind of stop. So in a nutshell, that's the backstory, I guess.
So how did you find your way out of that, Sean?
So I have a book like Boys Do Cry. And in that book, there's a 3,500 word, just a small chapter about, you know, like basically perseverance and that it's okay for us to show emotion, right? Because the one thing that I would say to people or to your listeners is to not care what other people think and always express yourself, because holding on to that stuff is what got me to where I'm at. But if I could have done the short way and still got on the podcast, I would have chose that, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a great job. It's a rough background to kind of deal with sometimes. But I find things in my background all the time that help people move forward because they're either there or they've been there or they didn't see a situation that way. So all while I'm like, man, that was a really rough life. Now I'm grateful that it actually went that way because I'm able to turn it into something positive.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I love about your story, right? Because a lot of people do face obstacles or adversity, and adversity comes in all different flavors. But then it's how do we turn that into something that can help others? And that's what it seems like you're really doing.
Yeah. I mean, at the very height of my addiction, to kind of go back to your question, I was in a closet because people were looking for me, and then somebody knocked at the door, and I'm sitting in a closet with like jackets and stuff hiding me. And this part's in the book too, so I'll give people a teaser. But basically, I got hooked when I took that money and went and bought drugs. I bought them from the wrong people, and was deep into some stuff. And so I had some people looking for me, and I was with an ex-girlfriend, and she hid me in the closet, and they came in, and thankfully they didn't open that door, but she kind of just said, you have to get out of here. And I took my backpack, which had all my belongings at that point, and ran to a Greyhound bus station and called my mom and said, I know I've asked you for money a million times, but if you don't give it to me this time, like you might not have a son in the morning. And so I had to talk to her maybe for like maybe another half an hour, different phone calls. And my dad was able to get the bus ticket. And I went from Colorado back to New Hampshire. And I was sober for about a year. And then I found like DJing and club and stuff like that. And that's where the second, you know, kind of relapse happened.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. And that, I mean, it's scary.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier too, and your book, Boys Do Cry. Cause I think someplace I read you were like 43 or something like that before you really started to be comfortable, like expressing your emotions, or like maybe you've just taken it to a new level now. Why do you think that is so important in recovery?
I think that you go through life and we have these instinctual things that feelings are supposed to do, right? Feelings protect us when we're fearful. Feelings bolster or carry us when we're happy. You know, there's all these things that feelings and emotions do for a person intrinsically without regard, right? When you stub your toe, you grit your teeth and it's a reaction. And it's the same thing with drugs. Like, I know that if I use this substance, whatever I have going on right now or whatever just happened to me, I can go to this thing and it will erase everything that I'm feeling. However, because we like that instant gratification, we don't think about the 30 minutes after the feeling is gone. We go right back into that same feeling and then we end up using again. So yeah. I would say that it's important for you to understand or feel emotions and feelings because, firstly, communication. How do you communicate with somebody if you can't adequately say, I'm angry or I'm
sad? That's right.
My dad taught me not to have any of those emotions. So for my entire child and adult life, up till like my late 30s, I couldn't identify proper emotions. At 36 years old, I'm thinking like a guy driving up, you know, behind me fastly and beeping his horn and flashing his lights. I'm mad at that, right? Like, get off my butt. What are you doing? And yeah. And I this is almost in every single podcast because in therapy, my therapist said, do you think that when you looked in the rearview mirror, you were scared and the anger was a result of you being afraid that you looked up and you were like, oh my goodness. And I was like, there's a reason why you get paid so much money. Kind of. But honestly, that was my first kind of lesson, I guess, into like, am I feeling the right thing? So over, you know, 3 years, we've worked on how to properly identify emotions. And if I identify the wrong one, there's a little prompting and then I can usually get the right. But relationally, there's so much trauma there that even if I do make the right distinction of emotion, I backpedal myself because I'm, you know, like that's a whole bunch of backpedaling in my life. So I feel like to answer your question fully, your emotions, your feelings, and your thoughts are a large portion of being able to find recovery and then stay in it.
Yeah.
Because once those triggers and those cravings come, you have to be a strong enough willed person to say like, I'm angry right now, or I'm pissed off right now, or this feeling really hurts me and I don't want to go back to using to deal with it. So like, how do I do it? Now, the part is therapy. Treatment. That's where you learn like, okay, this is just a feeling. It goes away. And we've worked a lot on, I used to think that thoughts could hurt me because I was like, this is an emotion or a feeling, right? So by you, I guess if we talk about like a relationship, like by this person, you know, doing what they're doing or us not being together, I felt that I could physically get hurt from that. And so it was a, because of the relation to my, you know, to my dad, when that's something right. bad happened, I would get, you know, hit. And so in my therapist and I call it a rug pulling phenomenon, because it really is like a rug being pulled out from you. So right when you get comfortable and you think things are great, my dad was always there to yank that rug. So in every single relationship, there was always a rug until my late 30s. And now I know that I can stand on that rug without it moving. So,
yeah.
So now I'm able to have gainful relationships and positive influences in work, and be able to kind of ground myself more. So to answer your question, yes, I really feel like the emotions are a huge thing. And if anything, they should be kind of tackled in the forefront of that.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And it also, when you said the thing about the person driving up real fast behind you, beeping the horn, I can imagine how that would be fearful, or also like it would really send you into that, like, this is a threat, this is a risk, mm-hmm. you know? So now, Sean, is that something that the identifying emotions, is that something that you do in your work, or is that something you're doing personally, or both?
I think it's a whole, you know, it's all encompassing right now, because to identify them out, I mean, like, you should have saw me when I went into therapy and he was like, so how, you know, what's the feeling attached to that? And I got it right. I almost did a backflip in his office. I was like, I did it, you know, but it had to start there, because that was the safest place for me to learn. And then also another safe place to express them and say, maybe this isn't the wrong one, this is the right one. So now I can take it into work and I can literally sit inside, you know, my feelings are in with myself and say, is this really angering me or am I frustrated? Because those are vastly different, and you can deal with frustration a lot more than anger. You can turn anger into frustration just by how you talk about it as well. So I think therapy first was like, you know, I was grateful because I started to be like, I can feel this anger and it's not hurting me. And that's the thing he used to tell me is like, even in a relationship, like a woman can hurt your feelings or they can scar your emotions, but they will never physically hurt. And when I figured that out, that's why I was like, okay, like, let's do it. And you can give me any emotion now because I'm safe and I know that I'm safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that relates a little bit to something I think you were saying earlier, where it takes a lot of strength and I think confidence to be able to express your emotions, like, hey, I feel angry or I feel hurt. And I also think it's one of those paradoxes where it takes great strength, but also great vulnerability.
Right.
And I think a lot of people struggle with that because we want to be perceived as strong, like, you know, but just ignoring your emotions, that does not make you strong.
Yeah. It bolsters your weakness.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So I love that. I know I'm looking at my notes over here. You had said something in one of our correspondences that you hope that by sharing your life story, you help other people harness their self-worth. Can you tell me more about like what that looks like?
For me, self-worth is huge because all day long, people are telling you one way or another. I'm not going to say all day long, but if you come from this background, you're worthless. If you're homeless, you're not a productive member of society. I've had 12 years of you know, homelessness. If you're an addict, you are worse than the gum on somebody's shoe. If you grow up in a household where there's violence and there's, you know, there's all this like childhood trauma, pretty much, you become that, right? Mm-hmm. So I become a hated person. At 6 or 7 years old. Nobody likes me at that point because my dad told me so. So self-worth is something that takes a lot, but there's this thing that I call like a light bulb moment. And when somebody gets it and you can actually see that, that's what I mean where I get this gratification so much, because I've felt it, I've seen other people feel it, and I've helped people go from a part of feeling worthless and hopeless to allowing them to navigate their own story and find their own self-worth in the process. Because I think a lot of case managers or a lot of people will take on that helping role and they'll help, like, I'll help you to death. I will help you get there and I won't allow you to do any of it. So don't worry, you just have to sit there and answer questions and I'll get you where you need to go. And the greatest part of having the past that I have, it's like, I can show you what works. I'll give you 3 avenues. If you pick one and it doesn't work out for you, we have 2 other ones to go off of, but I want you to drive your own. You know,
they have to do the work.
I can be the gas. I can put the oil. I can do all that stuff that you want me to, but you have to drive the car. And so when people get this feeling of like I did, so sort of in the therapy session, like I get my own emotion. Like when somebody says like, I went to the DMV or I went to an appointment and I made it. Like nobody had to call me. Nobody had to check my, you know, me to check the time. Like I didn't have to call about it. I did it on my own. Those are those moments for me because I know that it's work. And I know that I don't use a lot of self-disclosure at work, but when it's warranted, I will use parts of my story to help somebody. And, yeah. and just in the past 2 weeks, there's been two instances where I did that. And the person, you know, was like, thankful to me. And I was like, don't thank me, like, thank yourself because you found a way to overcome that obstacle. And now next time it pops up, you can do it with no repercussion or, you know, anything like that. So
I think sometimes, Sean, I think people need to see someone who has made it through that journey.
Yeah.
Cause it is inspiring. Even if they go through it differently than what you did, the fact that you made it through it, that's inspiring. And I wanted to go back. You said just a few minutes ago, you said you helped them navigate their own story. How do you do that?
Because it's not, your story's never, it only gets written when you write it, right? And I can take this notebook that I have and I can tear a page out of it and I can throw it away and I can rewrite it. So why can't we do that every day that you wake up? Mm-hmm. Why can't we write a story every day that you wake up and you be the superhero of that story? You be the villain in that story. Whatever it is, I want you to be able to wake up and have a new outlook on life or a new way. So I always say there's 1.3 million people in New Hampshire. That's 1.3 million different ways to find recovery. So like, let's get to work, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the only way that you can do anything is to start putting one foot in front of the other. However far your gap is, if you're toe to toe, it doesn't matter. If you need to go backwards, it doesn't matter. Just don't stay there. You know, pause where you are, stop where you are, sit down if you need to, but like limit living behind you because you can't do that today. You can't go backwards. You can go and try to fix things, but you're not going to be able to. So if what happened 5 years ago is hurting you and it's bringing you to a place that you're totally debilitated, like what can we do today to help you move forward so that 5 years doesn't own your entire existence?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It reminds me of something I heard years ago. I was going through kind of a bad time and it was, you can always start a new beginning or write a new beginning at any point. And I know it sounds so trite and everything. And it's so easy because it sounds trite. It's easy for people to say, oh yeah, whatever. But that doesn't mean there's not great truth in it. And something you just said a minute ago too, you can be a villain, you can be a hero. And what I'd even say too, you know, some days for any of us, we might have a day that we're not at our best. That doesn't mean tomorrow we can't be the hero or, you know, the protagonist or whatever to use the terms I barely remember from literature, but we can.
You know, maybe
we can,
you just want to put the pen down that day and you don't want to do it. And that's totally fine. You don't have to, you can do that. But for us, it's, you got to pick the pen up again. Sometimes you have to force yourself to write. So who are you going to be and what are you going to do? And I think like the navigating for case management is, a lot of the time these guys come to us, they need sober living facilities or they need housing, access to medical care, access to the community resource system, access to recovery coaches, access to a case manager. So I work in a community health center, which has most of those spokes to the wheel in it. So we can, you know, hit most of those points within our agency, but my job as a case manager is to really just navigate with them. Hey, I'm about to go work two jobs and, you know, I won't have a break in them. So my job is, that's 16 hours in a row. You're freshly out of a substance use program. Do you think that working 16 hours, 4 days a week is sustainable? Well, like, yeah, of course it is. Well, like, let's think about this. And then it becomes a cost benefit analysis. So what's the cost of that? And what are the benefits? Now, if the benefits outweigh the cost, I'm going to allow you to go do that. Not really. And this is a bad situation because I don't want anybody to work doubles all the time.
That's right.
But, you know, like in a regular other situation, I'm going to allow them like, go test drive it. If it doesn't work, come back and we'll figure it out. And I'm not going to give them a huge length of time because I know like this is not going to work out for you, you know, but also, allowing them to own their own story. So we go off of case plans and we have requirements, and I put like, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. What's a goal for this phase that you want to do? Because if I can get you to buy in, then the requirements that I have aren't as bad, because in the process, you're getting to do my stuff and your stuff.
That's right.
So, yeah. So there's always little tips and tricks and ways that, you know, motivational interviewing is another one of my favorite things to do. So we do a lot of that, and that, you know, I can pull out stuff in a half hour conversation that people swear, like, I'm not going to tell you this. And I'm like, okay, let's try it. And through motivational interviewing, I'll be like, well, you just told me. And they're like, no, I didn't. And I was like, you did. It's right here.
You did.
You know? Yeah. So.
And hey, since you brought that up, because not everybody's familiar with the term motivational interviewing, how would you describe that to someone?
I would say motivational interviewing, if you take both things, it's me interviewing you to find out what motivates you. If our goal is for you to stop using substances, what motivates you to not? A common question that I ask is like, what gets you out of bed in the morning? You would not believe how many people say my kids. And I have to say, remove your kids, like take them out of it. Your kids don't exist. What gets you out of bed? Is it, I got to go to work? Is it, I'm happy to be alive? What is it like for you yourself? Like, and then it kind of goes, well, you know, it's my kids because of this. But no, like when you, like your brain tells you like, get out of bed. Your body tells you get out of bed, but your brain tells you to lay there for a while. Mm-hmm. So it's that balance. So what motivational interviewing to me is just going through a series of questions for me to find out what it is that makes you tick, because then I can use those things to find a way to apply them to what we're working with so that we can both have a better outcome.
Yeah. It's such a powerful, it's a powerful tool, what you're talking about there. Yeah. I wanted to go back to a minute ago, you said the thing around taking it out on a test drive, like something that someone's trying out, let them do a test drive with it. I love that, you know, because in coaching, what I often find is sometimes in, you know, we always hear this, people are resistant to change. But what I've found is that most people are not resistant to testing something, right? But it's that fear, oh my God, I have to make a change. And then what if I fail and blah, blah, blah. And all this chatter starts. But if you just say, hey, are you open to testing it? Or let's try a test drive. That implies it may or may not work. And it also implies we may have to make adjustments. And I think that sets people up for so much more success than the ironclad, whatever. So I also want to shift gears. Oh my God, I just said shift gears after test driving. Didn't mean to, you know, work on that. But I know you're working on, you have an upcoming, you're working on a new book, right?
Yes.
And in that you talked a little bit about the rug phenomenon, but I wanted to go into that a little bit more. And also you have the other analogy of the trauma backpack. And I wanted to make sure we had time to talk about both those. So
the trauma backpack is actually my favorite thing, because I'm in therapy and I'm like, I'm just carrying around this trauma backpack. And my therapist was like, what'd you say? And I said, a trauma backpack. And he's like, Google that. And I did. And I only found like two or three things. And he was like, what you need to do is take that and use it, because, and so I did, I created a whole, I actually in the middle of working out a children's story right now with a kid who works with trauma at home and not being able to talk. And, you know, he keeps putting these things back there, not realizing that they're weighing him down. It's just this whole thing. But my therapist was the one who was like, you need to take that and go with it. So the way that I got to that was, for me, like at a really young age, probably starting at 5 years old, is like the first memory that I can really remember. And it would take me a little bit to go into that. But so my dad ended up taking me somewhere that when he wasn't supposed to, like five states away from, you know, where we live. Wow. So that's my first memory, but that's like stuff like, how do I process this? I'm five. I don't know. I'll just stick it back, you know, go through life. And you put these things back and back and back. And next thing you know, that thing gets so full that there's papers all over behind you. And then you got to get to a point and turn around, look at all the stuff that you've dropped. And now you got to go back and pick it up. And like, that's double walking, right? So I don't want to get all the way back there and say that I didn't deal with any of it. So for me, the trauma backpack is just an analogy to say, like, this is where I put everything. And when I'm able to, or when I figure it out, I can go back there and I can pick it up and I can deal with it and I can go to the side. But this thing for 35 years, it's always been full.
Wow.
So right now in this 5 years, the past 5 years, for me, it's like, I actually have space now. And for a lot of the, you know, the firsts, I'm not putting anything back. I'm able to get it and deal with it, and I don't have to hold on to it. And so that's why I use the trauma backpack, because at some point your backpack's going to break and it's not going to work anymore. And what are you going to do? Right. So that is still kind of a work in progress, but I use it a lot in like nonprofits and, you know, in talks with like community partners and stuff like that around like compassion fatigue and, you know, and burnout and stuff.
Yep.
The rug.
It's a great, just real quickly. That's a fabulous analogy. The trauma backpack. It really is. And it reminds me, I had a guest on the show. It was over a year ago, Jim Vave, and he is at 6 Seconds, which is an emotional intelligence organization. And Jim works with, I can't remember if it's death row inmates, but it's inmates, serious, hardcore criminals. And he talks about that trauma that's not transformed is transferred. And it just kind of reminded me, we're like, you know, you were talking about like, now you're no longer continuing to put stuff in the backpack, but the longer we go and not deal with it, we keep adding to it. So that is just a brilliant, brilliant analogy. So now, okay, sorry for interrupting you there, but I just wanted to make sure I commented on that. The rug phenomenon. Oh, go ahead.
And also, luckily for me, like I'm able to deal with this stuff outside. So it's not only just the progression to show somebody this is where you put stuff and this is how most people deal with it without realizing, but it's also now like, I've dealt with this so long that like, I don't want to deal with it anymore. And that's pushing me to fix it. But now I can help somebody in another way, because now trauma doesn't affect me like it used to. And it might still hurt, but nothing can cause physical pain. And I know that. And now I'm able to work through it. So there's that. The rug phenomenon is something kind of that my, you know, like we worked out in therapy. And that's just basically that, like I've walked on eggshells my entire life. You know, when I did show emotion, it was met with anger, hostility, violence. You don't do that here. You know, stop crying, all the female names that you can call a man. So what it is not being able to have a stable foundation anywhere. Like throughout my entire childhood from 5 to 17, there was no stability. It was just like, you do it my way. And my way is the only way that you can do it. And if you don't do it that way, it's met with force, right? So I'm 43 and I still fold my clothes the same way that he taught me when I was 7 or 8 years old, because it's just the habit, right? Like
That's right. Do it.
And I mean, most people will say that like, oh, you sounded like your dad or your mom when you know, you say that, but these things were like built in a bad way. So, and I had said, you know, or alluded to or said earlier that, you know, how can the person who says they love you the most be the one that causes the most pain? And I think that's where the rug phenomena is that my dad did this push-pull thing where he would make you feel like everything was great, your life was amazing, like all this. And then he would realize that. And in 1 second, he would pull that rug out and he would be like, you're the worst kid. You know, like all these statements and stuff. And that's where a lot of the backpack stuff came from too. But it's this thing where you never can provide stability or stand on your own 2 feet or become your own person, because you're always afraid that that rug is going to just swipe your feet out from under you. And that's where we came up with that.
Yeah. The uncertainty. And of course, what do kids need a lot of? Certainty.
You know, and I feel this with my own daughter. Like I did the baby, like the infant in the baby years. And even now, like there was a point where she now has anxiety and she's dealing with some, you know, depression stuff. And I have to go back and think, like, did I do something when she was younger that caused this? Because that's kind of how it came, you know, for me is like these things built up and now I'm just an anxious person because of, you know, my upbringing. So I've been able to kind of talk to her about it. She's 11. So we have like, you know, pretty sophisticated conversations for, you know, at an 11-year-old level.
That's right.
And she's able to articulate, talk about her feelings. She knows that it's a safe place. And I always just tell her, like, you are free to feel whatever emotion you want. I just don't want you to hold on to it. So you talk, if you want to talk to a teddy bear, if you want to talk to your cat, I don't care. I just don't want you to sit with it. And it's something that I did. Please be okay to let me know, like, dad, this hurt my feelings, or dad, I can't do that right now because of this. And we work. And so I realized that some of the stuff she has going on right now could have been the upbringing, because I've never raised a kid before. I've never physically done anything. I've raised my voice maybe twice. She knows that we're more serious when my voice is lower than it is higher. And so, and it could just be the the anxiety or the, you know, like the inattention could just be because they're hereditary. I mean, like who knows?
That's right.
But I try to provide her solutions to not feel like that. And I always tell her to, at the end of the day, if you're happy, then that's all that matters. And if you're holding on to things, even if you don't understand them, talk to your mom, talk to me, talk to somebody at school. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have a kind of a safety and a support plan for her in place at this young age, because when she gets older, if she does this now, you know, older is just going to be a like going by the numbers. And talking about her feelings at 17 will be vastly different than 12, because she'll be okay with it. And she'll know that it's okay for me to share these things, because when I do, people wrap around me or people help me. You know, people just don't leave me out there to have my own vices.
Right. Right. And I think the stuff about the anxiety, have you ever heard of positive intelligence, PQ for short?
Yes. Yeah. Through work. Yeah.
Okay. Love that program, by the way. And something that Shehrzad Shamin, he's a lecturer at Stanford, and he's the kind of the founder of that whole thing. He talks about it, that anxiety starts in many people at a very young age. And it actually, in the most stable of environments, the most loving of environments. So it can happen at any time. The other thing too, this is just a resource for you. I've recommended this for many people. She's based out of the UK. And I think her website is Hey Sigmund, and she deals a lot with anxiety in kids and teenagers and even adults. And I found her stuff to be amazingly good. And I have a few friends who have teenagers or teenage grandchildren, and they're like, oh my gosh, how do we support them with their anxiety? And they found her stuff to be really, really good. And I mean, my goodness, just being the kid today, it's so much more stressful than it was when we were younger. I mean, I never had to worry about a school shooting, and now they have drills for it, you know? All right. So this has been great, Sean. So how can people, if they want to connect with you, if they want to learn more about your books or what you're doing, how can people do that?
My website is easyshauncoffee.com. It's S-H-A-U-N and coffee with a Y. There's so many jokes throughout my Instagram life about that. So you can do Instagram, which is the only social media that I really have right now. That's Willows and then _runner. And then just my website, there's a link to the book. I think I have 4 or 5 podcasts on there, and I'm starting to load up like videos of speaking engagements and stuff.
Oh, nice.
The second book will be done hopefully in June. So if people do go to the website, though, you know, all that stuff will be available there. But
nice. Yeah. And do you have a title yet or a working title for the second book?
No, man. I think I did that because I was afraid that if I created a title that I would pigeonhole myself. And so I'm just going to write it, and then we deal with all the creative stuff afterwards.
That's perfect. And I noticed that in your Instagram, part of your handle was runner. I think I remember this. Are you an ultra marathoner?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. How many have you done?
Like 5 or 6.
Oh my God. And those are how many miles?
I'm like 50K or more. So about 30, 33 miles to 240. I've never done a 240, but there's a race in Moab, Utah. It's called the Moab 240. So that was a product of substance use and not being in therapy. And I didn't even like to walk downstairs to my car from my apartment. And I found a trail one day and I started walking, and then I was like, I think I can run. And next thing I know, I'm running 10 miles. And I just have this really stupid ability to shut my brain off so that there's no pain receptor. And then I get into a trail and it's just me and my feet and the birds and everything else. And it's super therapeutic. And that's where I did a lot of my therapy when I first was figuring out, what do I do with this anxiety? And what do I do with this, like, you know, these feelings, but just get them out running. So
that's right. And it's a great place for your mind to just kind of chill. And awesome. So, hey, in any final words that you want to offer to the listeners before we wrap up?
You'll find my email and stuff on the website. I would just implore people, if they want to know more, or they, you know, they have extra questions or they need support, I respond to everything. And I just encourage people to take the next right step, you know?
Yeah.
That's really all I offer. And it works for everybody. And if you pause, you know, pausing and one foot in front of the other, those are the basics.
Yep. And the next right step. I love that. What a great way to end. So Sean, thank you so much for being a guest and for making the time to be here today.
I thank you for your time as well. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed this conversation. I loved how real Sean is and how committed he is to helping others in life. I just love that. So here are my insights, and I'm sure you had your own, but here's some of the things that really stood out to me. Number one, sometimes our backgrounds lead us to our purpose, and we can often harvest things from our past that we can use now to help others. Number two, I love what he said. Don't care what other people think and be courageous enough to express yourself. And part of that, it seems, is to get really good at identifying your own emotions, which is kind of tied to insight number three, but it really struck me how important and perhaps difficult it can be to really be able to identify your emotions and then how that leads us to safety and confidence. Number four, ignoring your emotions doesn't make you strong. It bolsters your weakness. Insight number five, your story only gets written when you write it. And I love how Sean said it. You can always tear the page out and throw it away and start a new page. And as he also said, some days it's okay to put the pen down. Insight number six, I really love the metaphor of the trauma backpack. It is so on point. We put things in the backpack and we don't even know what to do with them. And then they stay there. You know, I have this visual of the backpack getting heavier and heavier and heavier, you know, and dragging us down. So I think it's important that we recognize that we might be doing that. Number seven, Sean expressed it this way, limit living behind you. You know, we can't do anything about the past. We can do absolutely nothing about the past. And by the way, when we are living in the past, that is one of the key ways that we bring more stress into our lives. And finally, number eight, sometimes you just have to take the next right step. And even if you don't know for sure if it's the right step, what I implore you is take a step. You can learn from it. Even if it's the wrong step, you can learn from it, but it will move you forward. So I hope that you found inspiration and insights that will help you move forward in your own life. I just want to say thank you so much for listening and for sharing these episodes. I cannot even tell you how much I appreciate that. My sincerest hope is that this podcast is helping you take action in the face of adversity, challenge, or change, and that you continue to thrive no matter what.